MechCast, Saturday, October 13th, 2012. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. I'm glad to be back here with you once again. I am back home from my trip to Northern California, Petaluma, the Mech Computer Expo. That's where I brought you the last MechCast from. Now we're back in the studio. It's been a huge week. Actually, take that back a little bit. It's been an odd week for Apple News. There's not a lot going on, but surprisingly, I've got a lot of stuff in my notes. So we definitely have some things to talk about. The new iPad Mini, we're supposed to be invited to an event. Maybe that didn't happen this past week. We're going to talk about why that is. More on the map stuff, and is it affecting iPad sales? Also, I have all of your great feedback and questions, got some really great tips. We're going to sit down with our friend Dave Sparks, talk about some Mountain Lion OS 10 tips that are really cool, and a whole bunch more things to get into. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. Actually, a returning sponsor to the MechCast is Citrix with GoToMeeting. They now have GoToMeeting with HD Faces, and you know, more and more these days with high-speed internet connections, with connected devices, more and more business is being done virtually, remotely. People are working in remote offices, remote locations. And now people don't need to be in the same office. They don't need to be in the same city, the same country, or even in an office itself. You don't have to be in a physical building in a cubicle. A lot of people are working from all over the place. But that doesn't eliminate the need to meet and collaborate and to get together and share ideas. And it often actually becomes more important when people are working on projects and they're in different physical locations. And that's where a tool like GoToMeeting with HD Faces comes in. Because you can be seen, you can be heard, you can share your ideas, you can share your screen, you can collaborate and work together to solve problems. As a matter of fact, I use GoToMeeting in my business. I do web development along with podcasting, and I use it to help train my clients. And I've had clients in New York. I've had clients as far away as Australia, and I've been able to actually build a website with WordPress and show them how to use the software, how to use the back end of the website using a GoToMeeting session. And it's like almost being in the same room, being able to turn your laptop screen around and actually show it to them. And best of all is that they don't have to be technical to get on a call and do the meeting. All they have to do is literally click a link and make a couple clicks, and boom, they're in a meeting, they're attending it. And GoToMeeting has mobile applications now, so Android, iOS, and HD Faces is supported on the iPad, so you can literally meet from any place. You can get an internet connection. It doesn't have to be in an office. You could be at the beach and literally have a meeting on a 4G connection using your iPad. So amazing stuff. And you can get a free 30-day trial. You just go to gotomeeting.com and you'll see the try it free button. Click on that and make sure you enter the promo code MACCAST, M-A-C-C-A-S-T, and sign up and you can try it free for 30 days. That's GoToMeeting. Meeting is believing, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MechCast. So the new iPods are starting to hit the streets. They started showing up this week, and that would be the 7th generation iPod Nanos, the 5th generation iPod Touches, and those new iPod Shuffles. They're arriving in consumers' hands. The new iPod Touch is getting some great reviews. Of course, it's taller and thinner and lighter. Performance has improved over the last year's model since it now adds the same A5 processor that was found in the iPhone 4S, so nice bump up in the processor. There's also improved cameras both on the front and the back, so you get better resolution, better color, better low light performance. And a teardown has shown some interesting details. iFixit, of course, did their thing, broke it all apart. They found that it has 512 megabytes of RAM versus the 1 gigabyte that's on the new iPhone 5. And yes, it does have a 4-inch Retina display like the iPhone 5, but iFixit described it as a much simpler and cheaper design. So it doesn't seem to be exactly the same display. They did find that the battery has about 1,000 more milliamp hours. So it's a 1030 milliamp hour battery versus the 930 that was in the prior generation. I don't remember Apple saying it was getting better battery performance, about the same, I believe. The power button, microphone, LED flash, and volume buttons in the teardown they discovered were all connected on a single ribbon cable. They noted that it made it easier to remove, but it also probably means that that component's going to be a little bit trickier in terms of replacement and repairs, because you got to replace the whole unit. So lots of components connected to the same thing. Something else that's a little bit disappointing is they discovered that it has a cheaper home button that uses a rubber membrane. One of the positive things when iFixit did the teardown of the new iPhone, the iPhone 5, was they found the home button was redesigned and likely more durable, a little bit better quality. This one seems to be a little bit cheaper. Of course, there's all the new colors and the Apple Loop wrist strap, along with the lightning connector on the new iPods. And one other odd thing that was noted is that the EarPods that are shipping with the new iPod Touch don't seem to have the inline mic or remote controls like on the iPhone 5. So that's a little bit disappointing. It makes it feel a little bit cheaper on Apple's part, in my opinion. I don't know why they couldn't have just included that, because you have technologies like Siri and the ability to use Skype and stuff like that on your iPod Touch. So it'd be nice if they would include that microphone along with the controls. But for whatever reason, they didn't. And yes, the new iPod does support Siri. Unfortunately, it only works when you're connected to Wi-Fi, and Siri overrides the older style voice controls. So if you had an older iPod Touch and you were used to using the voice controls, Siri overrides that, which means that if you're not near a Wi-Fi connection, your voice controls for controlling, say, the music player aren't necessarily going to work. If you want those back, I found a cool tip. You can actually go into Settings, General, into Siri, and hit the little toggle switch, toggle Siri off, and that will revert it back to the standard older style voice controls that were in iOS. The only bummer here is that disabling Siri removes some of the personalized data and information that gets sent out to Apple servers related to your Siri control. So that means you're going to have to re-upload things like the contacts information, and if you allowed it to do that, and that sort of thing will have to be rebuilt so that Siri can kind of relearn some of the voice stuff for you. But overall, people seem to be really enjoying the new iPad Nano, even with some of the little downsides. It's a much improved upgrade over last year's model or the prior generation model. New iPod Nanos are also out, and haven't heard as much about those. I'm sure we'll be getting some reviews in the future. One thing Apple did push out, though, is a software update for the new iPod Nano, software version 1.0.1. The only feature that's listed is support for the iPod Nano 7th generation. So if you picked up a new iPod Nano, you probably want to run your software update on iTunes and grab that. No word on what else it might improve. So you're probably aware that the relationship between Apple and Samsung is a little bit of a strange one. Apple relies on Samsung for a lot of the components for its devices, yet Samsung is also a competitor to Apple, and there's that whole lawsuit business that we've talked about in the past. And Samsung has even gone so far as to run some anti-Apple ads where they warn Apple users that they're about to get Samsunged. Well, turnabout might be fair play, because it looks like Samsung may be getting Apple. According to a report by iMore, there's some speculation by Citigroup Global Markets Inc. that Apple may move all of its quad-core chip manufacturing over to Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, cutting out Samsung from Apple's processor business. The main reason for the switch is believed to be that TSMC has a more efficient 20-nanometer manufacturing process, which Apple reportedly began verifying back in August, and it looks like they're ready to maybe pull the trigger and move forward with that. Apple's current chips that are produced by Samsung use a 32-nanometer process. Now, Apple's tried to create a stronger partnership with TSMC in the past, but they were reluctant to do so because of Apple's typically lower margins they offer to their manufacturers and suppliers. It's believed now, though, that the cost efficiencies of the new manufacturing process, along with Apple's potentially very large order volumes, have finally brought TSMC around. To date, Apple has yet to produce a true quad-core CPU design, but they did acquire the fabless chip company Intrinsity back in 2010 and have supposedly been working on and developing quad-core processors. Apple has produced quad-core GPU designs, like the one in the current generation iPad's A5X processor, but it's believed that quad-core chip designs are likely destined for future iPads, Apple TVs, and possibly even Apple's notebooks. And TSMC may begin quad-core chip production for Apple as early as next month. Apple also recently hired Jim Murgard, a leading chip designer who worked for AMD and most recently for Samsung, so pulling away Samsung's talent as well as their contracts. At AMD, Murgard was known for working on a high-profile chip designed for low-end portable computers, codenamed Brazos. There's some speculation that Murgard's talents may be used at Apple to help move their chip designs from mobile devices over to the Mac, and there have been some pretty strong reports that Apple has been playing around with and considering moving away from Intel for its CPU designs for Macs and notebooks, and might want to take the talents that they've garnered from designing their own mobile chips and bring that over to their desktop platforms. So that will be interesting to see. I think it's something Apple is very likely to do. They've gotten pretty good at designing those chips. They've also made a bunch of strategic acquisitions in that area, including grabbing talent like Murgard from other vendors. So we'll have to see what Apple does with all that talent and if they finally start making their own processors for Macs. But I think in the next 2-3 years or so, we may see that happen. So despite all the controversy surrounding iOS 6 in the Maps application, it looks like Maps is not one of the things affecting iPhone 5 sales. ChangeWave did a survey recently of 4,270 North American consumers about the iPhone 5 and got some interesting results. 32% said that they are somewhat or very likely to purchase an iPhone 5. That's up almost 10% from the same type of survey they did about a year ago with the iPhone 4S, where 22.5% of consumers said they were likely buying a new iPhone. Those who were not likely to buy a new iPhone 5 were asked if the recent Maps problem factored into their decision not to buy, and 0% said it was a factor. As a matter of fact, the most common reason given for not purchasing a new iPhone 5 or not wanting to purchase one was simply that they were happy with their current device. ChangeWave also asked iPhone 5 and iOS 6 users about their experience with the new Maps application, and only 3% said they experienced serious problems with the Maps. 6% said they had somewhat of a problem, and 1% said not much of a problem. But a whopping 90% said they had not experienced a problem at all. Now, note, the survey was done in the U.S. with U.S. consumers, and I personally believe that the map troubles are more of an issue outside of the U.S., but at least in this one instance, it didn't seem to play much of a factor in whether or not someone were to purchase an iPhone 5 or whether or not current purchasers were unhappy with the device. Actually, in ChangeWave's research, they found that the Lightning connector seemed to be more of a concern for buyers. 31% of likely iPhone 5 buyers called the new charging and data connection port somewhat of a problem, whereas 6% claimed it was a very big problem. So it seems like maybe there's a lot of people out there with older accessories and devices that are using the 30-pin dock connector, and the thought of upgrading and sort of having to swap out maybe all those accessories and spend that additional money might be playing a bigger factor in the purchase decision. Moving back to the Maps, though, I had thrown out and made some comments about my feelings on the whole map thing and asked you to give some of your firsthand accounts from different areas. And specifically, I was asking about, are things improving? Because I think when iOS 6 first came out and everybody started using the map application, we started seeing where the problems and errors were. And many of you wrote in to tell me your experiences. And what I found was holding true, that most of you either have not had any issues or not noticed many issues beyond some minor ones, and that those of you who have seen issues are reporting that Apple does seem to be responding fairly quickly and updating things. And I want to just give a couple of examples, starting with this comment from David.
Hey, Adam, it's David from rural Connecticut, and I'm a longtime fan of the MacCast, going all the way back to the fall of 2005 when I actually started my own podcast series here at the University of Connecticut. Well, I've been following all of the controversy about the Maps app, and I have an iPhone 5, and I was just driving out around this area and decided to see if I could actually use the iPhone 5 for accurate turn-by-turn directions to find my way home from a nearby town. So I tried that, and it worked beautifully. In fact, even better than my Garmin. Garmin always wants me to make a ridiculous turn that I never make because it's longer, and Garmin always has to recalculate. Siri knew from the get-go, well, the voice of the Siri-like voice in the Maps app, knew from the get-go that I shouldn't make that turn and to take me the way that I always wanted to go. So, you know, we're not near a big city. It's a small town called Tolland, about a half hour out of Hartford. But I have no complaints about the map based on my limited experience. So I just wanted to pass that along.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate you sending that in, David. And, you know, that's one example. It's a small example. But I think that's sort of how this conversation goes, right? We can point to where the errors are. We can also point to the really good things. And, you know, like I said, I think U.S. tends to be a little bit more accurate than maybe other parts of the world. But I also got this email from Andy, and he says, just some info regarding maps from an area you maybe don't hear from. On launch and up until a week or so ago, I asked it for directions from anywhere in Townsville to anywhere in Cairns, the two largest tropical cities in Queensland. Apple Maps could not compute any route at all. Absolutely diddly squat. Townsville and Cairns are about 350 kilometers apart, populations of around 200,000, and one road connecting them. So not too impressive, I have to say. Just checked now, and it's much improved. Routes are mapped and look reasonable, and as you search addresses, Maps is much more responsive at suggesting addresses. So the discussion of improvements, that improvements are occurring, appears to hold water, and importantly, regional areas in regional areas, not just big cities. Sorry about fumbling that a little bit, but you get the point, is that there was some errors internationally, and Apple has responded and started fixing them. And I've talked to a number of people. We actually talked to a bunch of people at MCE who had similar experiences where there were errors, and they went back to check about a week later, and those errors were being corrected. So it does sound like Apple is on top of things. They're working hard to help improve, and that's what I was hoping to see. Now, that's not to imply, again, these are isolated cases, but that's not to imply that everything is rosy and that everybody is happy. I also did get some emails from people who, this was a big enough issue for them. They said that they're not going to be buying an iPhone 5, and as a matter of fact, a couple people said they would be switching to an Android device so they could get their Google Maps back. So I certainly understand that, but I don't think we have the Macopalypse that a lot of people were reporting. I do think that things will improve. Apple will do a good job with this ultimately, and I still am not in the camp that they shouldn't have shipped this, that they should have waited longer. I think this is pushing them, it's driving them forward, and I think we're actually going to get the improvements more quickly, but that's just my opinion. So all that said, CNET does have a report from developers who say they filed bug reports with Apple, notifying them of a number of serious issues with maps before it was launched. The reports say that they told Apple engineers that there were issues, and Apple representatives said, yes, we're aware of the problems and that the issues are well understood. And so if that is true, it does seem to indicate that Apple was aware of the issues with maps and simply chose to ship the product anyway. And we can argue about whether or not that would have happened under Steve Jobs' watch or not. The assumptions are that he never would have shipped a product like that. But as I've talked about in the past, Tim Cook is a different CEO. He's going to do things differently, right or wrong. Many people feel this one is wrong. And he did have to come out and apologize for it. So maybe he'll learn from that mistake and be a little bit more cautious in the future. But again, not surprising that things are operating a little bit differently under a different CEO. And if that's a sign of things to come, if they continue to make these kinds of errors, I think a lot of people are going to continue to be upset with the maneuvers. I think there's bigger problems and bigger issues that have happened in the past. But, you know, we're going to look at each incident one by one and kind of make our assessments from there. Personal opinion on this one, as you can probably figure out, I don't think this was a huge blunder. I think it was sort of blown way out of proportion. But once again, that's just my opinion, and I know a lot of you don't agree with that. And despite any of these issues, maps and what have you, the iPhone 5 does continue to be a huge success for Apple. As a matter of fact, the ad network Chitika did a traffic analysis from October 3rd through the 9th, and they found that the iPhone 5 accounted for 56% of their ad impressions versus just 46% for the Galaxy S3. iPhone 5 having been out much less time than the new Galaxy S3. And the Galaxy S3 is obviously a very popular Android phone, but iPhone 5 did beat it out in terms of web traffic, at least in that one study. And not to be left out on the market share success, IDC says that the Mac gained US PC market share for the third quarter. Now, this news is a little bit bittersweet, however, because it just means that Mac sales are actually declining slower than their PC cohorts. Apple saw actually a 6.1% slide in US PC sales year over year versus an overall trend of 13.8% decline for PCs. The net result, however, was that Macs saw a net increase in their market share year over year, moving up percentage-wise from 12.5% to 13.6% of the US PC market, maintaining Apple's third-place position in the United States. Now, globally, Apple has yet to even crack the top five in PC sales, so they didn't list the rankings in that IDC report because they only covered the top five. So globally, we're not sure how Apple is doing, but their share is up about a percentage point, a little more than a percentage point here in the U.S. And as I alluded to at the top of the show, no iPad mini invites yet. No one really knows why the predicted invites didn't go out on October 10th, but many sites last week had reported that Apple would be shipping out invites to reporters and select people in the media on October 10th for an event they predicted to happen on October 17th. We now know, of course, that that didn't happen. As to why, there's only speculation, but there have been rampant reports of production delays due to screen yields on the displays and also some reports of possible issues with the back case of the new iPad, specifically that black model, and related to some scratching concerns because it has kind of the same finish as the new iPhone 5, and Apple has had some issues there that they've had to address. So that may be part of the reason for the delayed announcement. Either way, it looks like predictions are now pointing to an October 23rd event. This was reported on by All Things D, and they've proven very reliable in the past. It was also confirmed by the Loop's Jim Dalrymple, so it's looking very likely that that will be the date. I would assume if that's the case, we'll see some media invites going out next week. Assumption is that it will be a media invite-only event, and it will likely take place on Apple's campus in the town hall. So that's a smaller venue than the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts that Apple announced the iPhone 5 in, so we can expect the coverage to be a little bit smaller in terms of actual media that's going to be on site. The Next Web has also reported that the spin on the announcement will likely be focused around iBooks and education. So they're going to be positioning that new iPad mini as a lower price point media consumption type device that would be likely to compete with other media focused tablets like the Kindle Fire, the Nexus 7, and the Nook. The lower price device would also appeal more, I think, to schools and education since they work on tighter budgets, and it's expected that the price point will fall somewhere in the $249 to $299 range, so significantly less than the current generation new iPad. Apple may also be hoping that the lower price device will give a boost to their iBook textbook sales. Apple announced iBook textbooks back in January, if you remember, but arguably, so far, iBook textbooks have yet to revolutionize the textbook industry the way that Apple had hoped. I assume their idea is that if they can get more iPads into schools, into educational institutions, that that will help boost those textbook sales in the future. So we'll have to see how they actually run the event when it happens on the 23rd. So far as the specs go for the new iPad mini, here's what we think we know so far. A 7.85-inch screen running at a 1024 by 768 resolution. That's the same as the iPad 2. It's going to have the Lightning connector, possibly Wi-Fi only at launch, which would be interesting. Apple has also reportedly ordered 10 million of the devices, but as we mentioned a little bit earlier, suppliers are struggling to meet that quota, which may be part of the reason for the delayed announcement and launch. The iPad mini name is also not certain, and that's what we've been calling it so far, but there has been some speculation that Apple may go with a different name. I think John Gruber and some others are throwing out the potential name iPad Air. I think that has a little bit cooler ring to it, although it may imply more of a higher scale, higher end product than the price point. I don't know. I don't know what you think, but it seems like iPad Air puts it up there with the MacBook Air, and maybe that's what Apple's going for. The iPad mini seems a little bit more approachable and more toward the price point that it might end up at. But a bonus announcement might happen around the same time, and good news for those of you who've been waiting on that 13-inch MacBook Air. A display research analyst, Richard Shim, estimates that the release would happen around the same time as the iPad mini announcement, or at least shortly thereafter. He speculates that the 13-inch MacBook Air would have a resolution of 2560 by 1600, so just slightly less than the 15-inch model's 2880 by 1800 pixel resolution. But still good news. It looks like we might finally get that Retina 13-inch MacBook Air in October. And with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that's Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, Notebook is this awesome application for taking notes, for jotting down thoughts and ideas. It's also really great at doing research. I use it to help me prepare the show notes for the show, at least get started with finding articles and things like that, and that's because it has this great clipping feature. And what that allows you to do is define pages within your notebook that tie into a clipping service. So when you're on a web page, you can select some text, you can go to your services menu and clip that right into your notebook without leaving the browser. So that allows me to browse through, find articles, find pieces, get them into my notebook, and then come back and organize and filter through them later. And it also works in applications like Mail and other applications with OS X. Because it's a service, it can work system-wide, so it doesn't have to just be from the web. And that clipping, when you get back to your notebook, has a little sticker on it that gives you some additional features, things like snapback. that lets you jump back to the original site or article, also back to your original email. And if it's coming from an email, it'll also pick up additional information like the sender's contact information. And if they're in your address book, you can get quick access from right inside Notebook to things like their phone number, address, additional contact information, and then bonus, all of that stuff is indexed and made searchable. It has this great feature called the Multidex that indexes things in a bunch of different ways, so you can see all of your clippings one place, you can view all the links and trackbacks in another place. It's just a very versatile application, and if you haven't checked it out, you really should. They have free 30-day trials available on the website over at circusponies.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out their new application, iTrash, which gives you the ability to put your trash icon right back on the desktop where it used to be in Mac OS X, along with a bunch of other cool little bonus features like animations and sounds and stuff like that. So really fun application. Brand new from Circus Ponies. You can find all of that at circusponies.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. On the last episode, I told you about an issue one of our listeners was having with playing audio and pausing it by pulling the audio cable out of the headphone jack. This is actually a really cool feature in iOS, where if you're playing something in the music app or the podcast app, anything that's playing audio through the headphones, and you just simply remove the headphones, it will actually pause what's ever playing, and then you can come back to it and listen to it later. And I use this feature all the time, so did this listener. But what he noticed was that there was a little bug. If he did that and a notification came in or an event happened on the iOS device, suddenly the audio would fire back up and start playing through the iPhone speakers, even when his device was on mute. And so we offered a couple suggestions. You know, my suggestion was to simply make sure that you quit out of the application if it's running as a background process so that that doesn't happen. That obviously doesn't fix the underlying issue. But Darren wrote in to let us know, because we had thought this was maybe an iOS 6 bug, but he wrote in to let us know that he's encountered the bug also on his iPhone 4S prior to iOS 6, so running iOS 5, and that would seem to indicate that this bug has actually been around for a while and isn't something that Apple has addressed yet. Darren notes that he works around it by actually pausing the playback prior to pulling the headphone jack cable. So not as convenient, but will stop that audio from playing in the background. The other thing that Darren explained that I completely forgot is that, you know, this listener was surprised that the audio would play even when the device was on mute, but it's actually a fact that the audio will play through the podcast app and the music app and some of the other apps even when the device is on mute. So mute really only mutes the alert sounds and rings and stuff like that, but if you're using an audio application that plays through the speakers, that will actually play through even when the device is on mute. So that part of it makes sense. But what still doesn't make sense and where the bug is that it shouldn't start playing up the audio just because an alert comes in. So just some additional information on that issue. Something that happened a little while ago, I think about last month, is Apple started converting or adding, rather, iCloud.com email addresses to a number of prior Mobile Me accounts. And that's caused a little bit of confusion and some issues for some of you. As a matter of fact, I received this question from Gary.
Hi, Adam. This is Gary. I love the show. I have been noticing that when I go into my iPad and my iPhone, now when I create new messages, I have this new at iCloud.com extension on my email. And then when I go and look in settings, it doesn't show like any new email in there. It just has my normal at me.com address. I don't see any indication that, oh, make an iCloud address. Just wondering if you've had any experience with that, if that's something that we might want to talk about on the show. And I haven't really looked into it further just because it doesn't really bother me. I just switch it to my at me.com, which more people are familiar with. I like it being iCloud, but I don't really know why it started. All right. Love the show. Thanks, Adam. Bye.
Thanks, Gary. Yeah, it probably started when Apple did the transition. Back in September, as I was mentioning, as part of that iCloud transition, they gave all customers a new at iCloud email address. And that would be in addition to your @me.com address. So it sounds like somehow iOS 6 got set up with that as the default. I think what might be happening is in iOS 6, when you set up an iCloud account, it automatically sets the sending address to your @iCloud.com address rather than your @me.com address. But I think you should be able to actually change that. If you go into settings under mail, contacts, and calendars, and then tap the iCloud account, and then inside the iCloud account, tap on the account name, and that'll take you to a screen where you can tap on the email address under the advanced section. I think that's down toward the bottom. And that actually should show, I believe, the default address that you're sending from, although it sounds like you said that should be your @me.com address. But if it says @iCloud.com there, that might give some indication as to why you're experiencing what you're experiencing. But regardless, you click on that, and when you get to the next screen, you'll notice at the bottom there's a bunch of on-off toggle switches. You can toggle on and off the different sending addresses, iCloud or @me.com, email addresses or aliases that you want set up for that account. So that's kind of an extra thing. If you just want to turn off the iCloud one so it can't even pick that, you could do that there. But what you probably want to do is tap on that email address under the advanced section. That will take you into another screen where you can tap on the email under email and then choose which address, @me or @iCloud, is the default address you want to use. And that the default address will be indicated by a checkbox on that screen. So make sure you have it checked to your @me.com address, and then that should be the default from that point forward. You'll have to tap done, I think, twice to get back out to the email account page and to save those settings. But once you've done that, that should sort of fix things. And if you've left those toggle switches on to allow you to also send from your @iCloud address when you're composing a mail, you should be actually able to switch it. Now, I looked into how you would set this up on the Mac as well. If you go into the Mail application, into Mail Preferences Accounts, and then you click on your iCloud account, in the Account Information section, you can set the email address option to whichever email address you prefer to use, either your @me or your @iCloud.com address. And in there, you just simply type that in. But you can use either with your new iCloud account, whichever one you prefer to use. So there's that. And of course, as I was saying, when you're composing emails either on your iOS device or in mail.app, you can at any time change the from field to whichever address you want. In iOS, you simply tap on the from field and you'll get a scrolling list that you can pick from. In the Mail app, it's a drop down and you can drop down and select the sending address you want. So that'll allow you to switch between for individual messages. And so that's kind of handy because you're not necessarily locked into the default. You can override it if you need to. So hopefully that's what you ran into, and I hope that tip helps you out. Now, here's a cool little tip that I found on Cult of Mac. For this one to work, though, you need to be running Mountain Lion, and you also need to enable Twitter integration. So this is a Twitter tip that works with the Contacts application. So you do that, and if you've allowed Twitter to either update your contact records to add Twitter information or at least gone in and manually added Twitter account information to your contacts, this will be a really cool little tip for you. Now, if you haven't enabled Twitter in Mountain Lion, the way you do it is you go into System Preferences, you go under Mail, Contacts, and Calendars, and then you're going to click the little plus icon to add an account, and you'll see that Twitter is a new option. So you select Twitter, you enter your Twitter account information, and then you'll be set up with the Twitter integration in Mountain Lion. And once you have that set up, you'll notice there's a button on that screen that says Update Contacts. If you click that and confirm that you want to allow it to update your contact records, it'll actually take your address book information, sweep through that, and try and match it up with your Twitter account to find Twitter followers that you have. And if it matches address book records, it'll put that information into the Twitter field in the Contacts application. And so once you have that in there, when you go into the Contacts application, you can locate a record that has a Twitter name in it. And if you click on the little label there that says Twitter, you'll notice you have two options. You have a tweet option and you have a view tweets option. So clicking on the tweet option will bring up a tweet sheet right inside the application and allow you to do an at reply to that contact, directly from that contact without leaving the contacts application. If you choose the view tweets option, it will actually launch your default Twitter client and place you right on the screen to show you the Twitter stream for that person. So a handy little shortcut if you have the contact record open for that person. So I thought that was kind of cool and something that I hadn't run across. So that's one mountain lion tip for you. I actually have a few more because I was able to sit down with David Sparks. He has a new mountain lion tips book out, and we talked a little bit about some of our favorite new mountain lion and OS X tips. So, hey, Dave, how you doing?
Great. How are you, Adam?
Good. Nice to have you back on the show. And you've got another new book out, right?
Yeah. Aren't you tired of hearing about me yet?
No. It's been a little while. You know, Paperless was awesome. I know a lot of people really loved it, and it's great to see you guys moving forward. Actually, I'm saying you guys now, like, people already know that you did this one with a partner, but yeah, this was a collaborative effort, right?
Yeah, it's called 60 Mountain Lion Tips, and I did it with Brett Terpstra. Brett Merlin and I did a session at Macworld last year about tips and tricks, and people loved it, so we thought it'd be fun. And it's always hard to communicate these things, so you know, using the iBooks author tool, we made 60 tips, and there's a screencast for almost every one of them where you can watch us do the tip and not just read about it. You can watch us do it.
Well, cool. And so what I thought would be fun, because I love tips and we share a lot of them here on the MacCast, and you were gracious enough and let me have a look at the book, and I found a couple of my favorites. So I thought it'd be fun to just maybe give the MacCast folks a few cool little mountain lion tips, maybe some of your favorite ones from the book. I have a couple of my favorites from the book, and you know, we'll see what we get.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. So one of mine, and it's funny because, you know, this has been around for a while, but even just in sort of rewatching the video, you forget some of these tips. And it was the window resizing, which I think actually came to being in Lion, where you could grab any edge and sort of resize from any edge.
Yeah.
And so that alone is a cool tip by itself. But what I always forget about is sort of the additional options when you hold down like the option key. So like, you know, hitting the option key and grabbing an edge, and then it sizes from not only that edge, but also the immediate opposite edge if you're grabbing from the middle. And then of course, sort of grabbing the corner to have it go from all the different edges while holding down the option key. And then the last one is that whole ability to constrain the proportions. So if you have it in a certain aspect ratio and you want to maintain that, if you grab the corner and hold down the option and shift, it will sort of zoom in and out from the middle, maintaining that aspect ratio. So it's one of those that's kind of like a simple tip, right? But very, very useful.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, that we had that feature for years, the ability to resize windows, I mean, since the original Mac, but at some point they decided to kind of upgrade it a little bit, and they didn't really make a big deal about it, so people don't realize it's there, but it's pretty useful.
Yeah, I forget about it. And again, it's a lot of the little extra stuff that you forget about, so, you know, having a reference to sort of remind you that, hey, there's these cool things in here. So that's one of mine. Do you have one that maybe you discovered during the course of the book, or that was kind of new to you?
Well, I have one that I rediscovered that I was very happy to bring back. It was using Mail, an Apple Mail. If you have more than one email account, it's always a pain when you go to send an email because you have to take the mouse and go select the account that you're sending from. And inevitably, it's got the wrong account listed as the default, so you've got to go and flip it. And so anybody who has more than one email account knows about this. Well, for years, you could set a keyboard shortcut to set that, so you could just hold down a keyboard shortcut and it would automatically change the send from account on Mail.
Mm-hmm.
That came back with Mountain Lion, and I was very pleased to discover that. In fact, every major update to the OS X, I would always test it to see if they fixed that, and they finally did with this one. So I was happy to put that back in the book.
Is there a trick for setting that, or is that pretty straightforward?
Well, it is. It's kind of a trick. So if you look at the entry, when you create a new email message,
right,
there's the little drop-down box. You click it with your mouse, and it gives you a list of all your accounts.
Yep.
So you create a keyboard shortcut for InMail that has that text exactly as it's written. For instance, in mine, it's got the angle brackets around my name and then the email address. And so you have to put it exactly like it is in there, then create a keyboard shortcut. But once you set it up, that's it. Just restart mail, and you're off to the races.
Okay, so that's where you go into System Preferences, into Keyboard, and the Keyboard Shortcuts tab, and then under Applications, you'd pick Mail.
Yeah.
And then add the shortcut, and the key is to make sure that you type the email address that appears in that dropdown exactly the way it appears in that dropdown.
Yeah, it's very empowering. If you have more than one email account, it will save you so much time.
Okay, and if that's confusing to you, it's in the book, so...
Yeah, actually, in the book, I walk through.
There's a video, yeah.
In fact, that's probably not a very good one to share here because it does take a few steps to get it set up.
I think most people will get that, but again, you've got the reference to go to, so that's cool.
Yeah, another one I really like is the three finger tap where you three finger tap.
That's another one of my favorites, and that is new in or changed in Mountain Lion, I guess I should say, right?
Yeah, I believe it was a double tap before. Now it's a single tap.
Yeah. So you want to explain that one?
So when you're writing any word, just take three fingers if you've got the magic trackpad or the trackpad on your laptop and just tap, put it over the word and just tap that. And it opens up a definition right there.
Yeah. And you also get the Wikipedia and the thesaurus.
And if you want extra points, you can go into the dictionary app and you can change the display order. So, for instance, I want it for the thesaurus much more than I want it for the dictionary. And the way I've set it up, you see the thesaurus first.
Yeah. And what's awesome about that one is, you know, it works practically in every application.
Yeah.
In OS X. There's that one notable exception that I think you point out in the book as well.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, my Microsoft Word is not going to work.
Why? Why, Microsoft? Why do you do this to us?
Well, you know, I think Microsoft and Adobe and some of these companies that are bigger, I didn't test it in Adobe because I don't have any of their apps running anymore, but some of these companies that are really big, and I'm sure Apple does the same thing, it's kind of a point of pride that they want to control the whole experience, right?
Right.
So they create their own open and save dialog boxes, and they have their own ways of rendering text and all these other things. And as a result, sometimes these internal tips that work throughout the operating system don't work in those applications.
Yeah. Yeah. So another one that I discovered through the book that I did not know about, and this relates to, you know, in iOS, they separated the Notes application and several of the other applications from Mail, and made them their own apps, and they're bringing everything into consistency with iOS. So, you know, Address Book is now Contacts, but you have the new Notes app, and that syncs with Notes and all that fun stuff. And I know we've had Stickies. Is Stickies still around in Mountain Lion? I know it was in Lion, the actual standalone application, right?
I believe it is.
I think it's still around.
It is.
But Notes now has a sort of sticky-like feature that I wasn't aware of. So if you're in Notes and you've got the list there on the left, if you just double-click on any note, it'll break it out into its own little element, and you can resize that. And when you leave Notes open and have it go back to the background, it leaves that just sitting there on the desktop, and it looks like your little sticky notes that you're used to.
Yeah, and it's iCloud-friendly.
Oh, yeah, so if you update the note, it'll automatically update on your desktop. Now, you do have to leave, correct me if I'm wrong, because I played with this, you do have to leave the Notes application open for it to stick around, right?
Yes, I believe so. This one was actually Brett's tip, but I've been using it, and I haven't. Yeah, I think you have to leave the app open.
So the note will stay up sort of in the background and just look like a little sticky note, but the app does need to be opened. So it's a bit same thing with sticky notes, right? You got to be running the app for the sticky notes to show up on your desktop. So. Yep. I thought that was a cool one.
Yeah, there's so many great little things about Mac OS X, and it's funny to me how there's so few resources to find out that they're there. It's like you have to be in the club to find out about them. That's really the reason why we put this book together.
Well, and that's why, you know, we've got MacCast listeners in the club now.
Yeah, exactly. Are you kidding? MacCast listeners founded the club.
Do you have another one? Or if you don't, I've got another one that I want to talk about.
Well, yeah. Well, let's see here. Oh, you know, one thing I like that got a lot easier now with Mountain Lion is setting the startup screen message. You know, they used to be really difficult to do that, but now you can set it up in the security preferences pane. And so when your Mac turns on, it gives a message. So like mine has my name and cell phone number. So if somebody picked up my computer and they were honest, they could get a hold of me.
So that shows up on the lock screen.
Yeah, it used to be that you had to go into the terminal. There's all kinds of madness that had to go on to play with that screen. But now you can just do it very easily. There's a whole screencast on that in there.
Very cool. Very cool. And that's just from the security and privacy settings. So the last one I'll get into, and then we'll let people pick up the book for maybe the rest of them, because it's really good. There's lots of good, 60 tips in there, of course.
Yeah.
But the last one is one that Apple brought back, and then it wasn't quite right, and that's the save as.
Remember? Yeah.
And they brought it back in Mountain Lion, but it still wasn't quite right. And then with the 10.8.2 update, they kind of fixed that. So I think I already covered for MacCast listeners how you could hold down, Command Option Shift S for this keyboard shortcut for save as, or if you hold down the option key, I think when you're going up to the save menu, the duplicate now becomes save as. But the problem was is that you would do the save as, and if you were doing it on a document you had already made changes to, it would keep the changes in the original document and also add them to the new saved as document, which really wasn't how save as worked. Like most people would use it where you'd open up a document that already existed, you'd make some changes, and then you'd do a save as, so you maintain the original document and now you have the new modified document.
Yeah.
So what Apple did now is when you invoke the save as function, there's a little checkbox that says keep changes in original document. So you want to uncheck that and do your save as if you want to have it back the way it was sort of originally.
Yeah. Don't you imagine this like religious war raging in the hallways in Cupertino over this whole thing?
Yeah.
I'm sure there is a lot of people at Apple that are very passionate about this on both sides of the fence.
Well, and it's very non-Apple to do kind of what they did this time around, which is, give their customers the choice. Usually Apple says, okay, this is the new way, this is the way it is, and that's it. Now you are kind of in control of your own destiny. So you can have it the way Apple thinks you should have it, or you should have it the way that maybe you think you should have it.
Yeah.
Or vice versa, however.
I bet there's a great story, though, behind all that, how it got to that point.
There's always great stories. If we could only have ears inside those, walls inside Cupertino, the kinds of stuff we would know. Well, David, again, another really great book. We just really scratched the surface. I don't think we gave away too much. There's a lot more stuff, great stuff in the book, and I encourage people to go check it out. If they want to do that, you have a website set up. Of course, they can go to the iBook store, but what's the website?
It's called 60tips.com, and you can go there.
Just simply 60tips.com. And it's, again, because it's...
number 60.
Yeah. and because it's got all the videos and all the interactive stuff in there, it's iPad, right?
Yeah, well, not really. You can get it. It's made for iBooks Author. So if you have an iPad, that's the best way to view the book. And it's $7. So we figured it's something like 12 cents a tip. So you'll be okay.
That's a deal.
Yeah, and it's an hour and a half of video. I mean, there's a lot of video screencasts in there. But so you can get it for your iPad. If you're on the iPad, go in the iBook store and download it. And it's got all those iBooks WYSI tools in there where you can jump through the table of contents and everything. It's a lot of fun. If you're not an iPad owner, or if you live in a country where you don't have the iBook store, there is a PDF version, and it's a PDF, but it comes with a folder with all of the 50-some screencasts. So you'll get, and they're all in an iTunes-friendly format. So you can just, you can buy the PDF and get all the movies to go with it and stick it in iTunes and watch it. So either way, if you go to 60tips.com, you'll find it. You can also find it at MacSparky.com.
So even if you don't have an iPad, you have some other thing that will open a PDF, some other device, you can buy that version and get it.
Yeah, I learned that with paperless. I mean, one of the nice things about kind of running your own publishing company is that you get to make decisions. And with paperless, a lot of people wanted it that had iPads even that lived in countries that they just didn't have it in their iBookstore. So I put that out the same way with the PDF version and all the videos, and everybody loved it. So that's the way of things now. So if you've got an iPad, though, I recommend reading it on your iPad if possible, because having it all encapsulated into one file is really nice.
Well, cool. Thanks, David. Yeah. I appreciate you sharing that with us, and go check out the book.
Thanks, Adam.
So there you go, David Sparks. Many of you know David Sparks also from this podcast, but also the other podcast that he does, Mac Power Users with Katie Floyd. If you haven't checked out that podcast, you really should. MacPowerUsers.com. You can also find it on iTunes. And, of course, his website, MacSparky.com, where he blogs and gives some great information as well. You should check that out. Dave's just a great guy, and he's a good friend. And I want to thank him again for coming on and sharing some of those tips with us. So I got an interesting email from James, and James was looking for, he brought up an application that I hadn't heard about in a while, but basically he wanted a replacement for AppleWorks, which was Apple's awesome sort of office suite all-in-one application that they had for years. I think it actually ended up at one point being a FileMaker product, if I'm remembering my Apple history correctly, and I hope I am. But a really cool app, and it was kind of one of those all-in-one apps where it had a word processor, it had spreadsheets, it also had a database that a lot of people really liked to use. And so what James is wondering is, now that AppleWorks is no longer supported on any current Mac, is there some sort of AppleWorks replacement? And in Apple's mind, I think the iWork suite replaces a lot of that functionality. But the one big piece that is missing for a lot of people is that database functionality. And of course, a good alternative for most people is Bento from FileMaker, which is a great application, allows you to do database style stuff, and very much in the vein of what was built into AppleWorks. But in James's case, it wasn't exactly working for him, because what he wanted to do was be able to take a group of addresses and produce a printed address book that he could put into a binder. And Bento can do that, but his real specific requirement was he wanted to be able to control the size of the label text. And that was something that didn't seem to be controllable with Bento. He got on with Bento support, and they said that really wasn't something that you could customize. So he's looking for a way to print out a printed address book, but to be able to control the font size of not only the text itself or the entries, but also the labels. And so I immediately thought, well, you know, in the contacts application or the address book, if you're on Lion, the print functionality and the print dialog, you can actually print out a list of contacts, a physical list that you could put into a binder. And, you know, maybe there's the functionality to kind of control the size there. So if you've never done this before, if you select your contacts in the contacts application, either all contacts, or you can select an individual group or even an individual set of contacts, you select them and you go to the file menu and you go to print, there are options in there. And if you don't see the options, make sure you click the little show detail button down at the bottom of the print sheet, and you'll see all the additional options for printing. And you're going to want to go under the style options and choose the list option. And then under that, you'll notice there's a bunch of attributes that allow you to control which specific fields you want to appear on your printed list. So you can set first name, last name, address. All of the fields are there and selectable. Turn on the ones you want, leave off the ones that you don't want. And then I noticed there is a font size that you can set, although there's only two options, either regular or large, regular or large. And even selecting large, while it did increase the size of the label as well as the entry, it didn't seem to make the labels all that big, and they were still significantly smaller, say, than the entry text itself. So the little preview window will actually show you what the page will look like, but you can print that way. Now, I don't think that's going to be exactly what James wants, so I thought another option might be to use the mail merge feature inside Pages. And what's great about this is this would allow you to go into Pages to actually design a layout however you want for those printed address book pages, and then be able to print it out, merging the data in from the contacts or address book application. So to do this, you open up a new pages document and, in essence, set up your layout specifically for the labels. And then format the labels however you want. You can make it whatever font you want, whatever size you want, which is, I think, is going to give you the functionality you're looking for. But then you're ready to actually put in your mail merge fields. And so to do that, you open up the inspector and you go to the link tab, and then there is a merge tab in there. So click on the merge tab, and then you'll insert the cursor wherever you want to place your merge field. Click on the little plus button inside the inspector and choose the add merge field option. Once you've added the field, then you can click on the little target name dropdown inside the inspector for the field that you just added and add the appropriate field type or appropriate field from the address book. So say, for example, the first name field, and then you'd put in the last name field and the address field, city, state, zip. Insert all of those into your pages document, and then when you're done with that, you are going to be ready to actually do your mail merge and generate the document that'll be the address book pages, the printed address book pages. So what you'll do once you have the page looking the way you want it is make sure to save it, and then go under the edit menu and choose the mail merge option, and then a little sheet will appear. Inside that sheet, you can select your merge source. In this case, it's going to be the contacts application, but you actually also could merge from a numbers document. And once you have that selected, you can go ahead and choose a contact group. You could choose all contacts, or you could choose a specific group. And then if you like, you could expand the merge fields section by clicking the little disclosure triangle, and that will allow you to double check and make sure that your mappings are all correct, that you're, say, for example, mapping the first name field to the first name in your contacts records. But once you've verified all of that, then the last settings to check is under the merge to options. You have the options to merge to a new document or to merge directly to your printer. Now, assuming you merge to a new document, what should happen is your result should be a multi-page pages document with one contact per page formatted in exactly the same format that you set up in the original document. So I think that's going to get you, James, to the point that you want. Now, if you prefer a more compact document, so you don't just have one contact on each page, you could create a page with multiple entries using a little trick. Once you have your generated multi-page document, you can go into the edit menu under Find and select the Find option. The keyboard shortcut for that, of course, is Command F. That will bring up the Find and Replace dialog. In there, go ahead and click on the Advanced tab, and then place the cursor in the Find field and click the little Insert dropdown and select Section Break as the thing that you're going to find. Then place your cursor in the Replace field. Again, click the Insert dropdown and select Paragraph Break. And I would actually do it again so you actually have two paragraph breaks in the Replace field. And then once you have that set up, click the Replace All button. That's going to go through your multi-page document and remove each section break, replacing it with two paragraph breaks, and that will compact your whole document into a single sort of continuous document with one address book entry after another. And you will probably have to go through and reset up any page breaks, but at least you'll have more than one record per page. And some people might prefer that layout to a single contact per page layout. So that's how you can use mail merge to accomplish what you want. I didn't find any other applications that would simply print an address book out of the contacts or address book application and allow you to format the field type. So that's the best solution I could come up with. If some of you have a better solution than that, maybe you know a third-party application for doing what James wants, send me an email, mattcast@gmail.com, and I'll try and pass that information along. So you may know that these days, if you want to soup up your old Mac, all the rage is centered around replacing your traditional spindle-based hard drive with a brand new SSD hard drive. But if you're aware of that, you're probably also aware that those things are really spendy. They're not the most cost-efficient way to get additional storage or upgrade the storage in your old Mac. And Brad recently wanted to upgrade his Mac and decided that he was going to try and get a little bit of the best of both worlds and go with what's called a hybrid drive. So he got a 500 gigabyte hybrid drive. And for those of you who are not familiar with what a hybrid drive is, it's designed to try and meet the needs of getting the increased performance of an SSD drive, a solid-state drive, but still have the additional storage and, more importantly, the cost per gigabyte savings of a traditional spindle drive. Now, Seagate pioneered this technology, I think, a few years ago. I believe they're the only company that's still sort of married to it and producing drives. And, of course, in no way it can match the performance of a true pure solid-state drive, but as you'll hear from Brad, it might be a good option for you if your storage needs are high and you're on a tight budget. So here's what Brad's experience was like.
Hey Adam, it's Brad over in Michigan. And I just wanted to throw a couple comments out regarding a new purchase that I made. I ended up picking up a Momentus XT Seagate drive. It's a hybrid drive for my 5-year-old MacBook Pro. Actually, 6 years old at this point, I guess. It's a late 2006. Basically, what I was looking for was an opportunity to put a little bit more performance in. I have my RAM's maxed out. And I had also read some good things about the hybrid drives overall. So I wanted to give it a try. I need our typically like about 500 gigs worth of storage. And I had an existing 500 gig 7200 RPM drive that did very well for me. And I decided I was going to swap these out for the Momentus and use that spindle drive as a backup. I ordered my drive from Amazon, kind of watched the pricing because it fluctuates quite a bit, and I ended up getting it for about $75 with free shipping. I've seen it go as high as $90 on Amazon, so just keep an eye on pricing if you're thinking about buying one. There's also a 750 gig model, and I think that goes like $120 to $140. So keep an eye on that one as well if you're looking for a little bit more storage. Overall, I'm extremely happy with the performance gain that I've got from it. It cut my boot time in half. Now let me say one caveat. The drives, at least my understanding after reading the specifications, only have 4 gigs of SSD memory, which doesn't seem like much, but what it seems like it still has done a heck of a job in speeding up my system. My understanding is the drive kind of monitors what you launch most frequently, what programs you use, and it stores those on the SSD portion of the drive. What I have found is, like I mentioned, my boot times moved from, I'd say, about 45 seconds down to 25. Safari, Chrome, iTunes, I'm trying to think of what else, basically load instantly for me now. And once I'm inside iTunes, it's much faster as well. Oh, and Mail app also is much better for me. You know, overall, I would just highly recommend it. I'd highly recommend you giving one a try if you're really considering one. You know, you're paying about a $20 premium on getting the hybrid drive over a regular spindle drive of equal size. And to me, I wouldn't even think twice about it. I'd spend that extra dollars, those extra dollars, and pick up a hybrid drive. I had battled over this, trying to figure out whether or not I wanted to go for it. I decided that I didn't want to get for the budget I had, I didn't want to get a smaller SSD drive and remove my DVD drive and use that second bay, you know, for a 500 gig drive and just do dual drives that way. I just didn't want to deal with it. So I took the best of both worlds and just went with the hybrid. That's about it, Adam. I really appreciate your show. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Thanks, Brad. I appreciate that. I haven't talked to too many people who have gone with the hybrid drive option, so I didn't know what this experience was like. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. As you noted, Seagate does offer a 750 gigabyte, 7200 RPM, 2.5-inch model. And that one actually has 8 gigabytes of SSD and a 6 gigabit per second interface. So if you want a little more SSD in there, you might want to pay the few extra dollars and go with the 750 gig model. As you mentioned, also a 500 gigabyte Momentous hybrid drive runs around $100, actually less than $100 in most cases, and sounds like you can get it as low as $75. And the 750 model runs, as you noted, around $130, and these are U.S. prices, of course. To give some perspective, a 480 gigabyte, 3 gigabit per second SSD drive currently runs right around $500 U.S. You could maybe get a little bit cheaper than that, but you're looking at almost a dollar a gigabyte versus about, I think it works out to like 20, 21 cents a gigabyte. So much better cost per gigabyte savings on the hybrid drives. Of course, you're not getting the full speed gains that you would with a pure SSD. And the hybrid drives really seem to be focused primarily on read operations, which is why you're noticing things like boot processes happening a lot faster, application loads happening a lot faster, and just general overall read applications or read operations feeling much, much snappier. So I think it is a good kind of middle ground and gives you a really nice price to performance ratio. So sounds like they're worth looking into. If I don't have the money for an SSD on my next hard drive purchase, I might actually consider one now. So thanks, Brad, again, for sending in that review. And then finally for today, I have a little quick tip for those of you who have the new panorama feature in the camera app in iOS 6. You know, after pressing the options button in the camera app, you get to the panorama feature. You can turn that on. And typically it sets your settings with the shot so that you hit the camera capture button and you pan the iPhone or iPod, what have you, from left to right to kind of scan across your scene and capture your pano. Well, you can actually set it up so that you can go the other direction if you'd like, moving from right to left. And it's as easy as tapping the little box that is on the left-hand side where the panorama would start. You tap on that and it will flip around and move over to the right-hand side, allowing you to go from right to left. If you like to switch it back, you go ahead and tap on it again and it'll flip back around. So cool little tip. Unfortunately, it does reset the setting the next time you access the panorama feature. So if you prefer to go right to left, it's not going to retain that setting. You'll actually have to do this trick each time you want to use that. But still a cool little tip. And I think I found that over on Cult of Mac, if I'm not mistaken. So wanted to share that with you folks. With that, that's going to do it for the episode for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook and iTrash. You can check out their software, get free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also PDF Pen for iPad and iPhone, as well as Text Expander Touch. You can get information on all of their software, as well as free trials of the Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, if you want to get cash for your old iOS devices, maybe your old Mac laptops, you can get a quote free over at gazelle.com. And Citrix, be sure to get your free trial of GoToMeeting with HD Faces. You can do that by going to gotomeeting.com, clicking on the free trial link, and be sure to use the promo code MACCAST. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. Also, a big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed, and for listening. If you'd like to support the show a little bit further, be sure to check out the MacCast member program. That's additional episodes that you can get by signing up over at member.maccast.com, and all the details are there. Also, please send in your emails, your audio comments. I love hearing from you. We played a number of audio comments, actually, in this episode, a little more comment-heavy, and I always like that in these episodes because we get to share cool tips and tricks and stuff like that and help you out. So you can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And you can also leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast. So a number of ways to get in touch. Also, be sure to check out the MacCast.com website. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum over at forum.maccast.com. Great place to hang out with other members of the MacCast community and get answers to your questions or just help out people in general. A lot of fun over there. Great folks over on the forums. So if you haven't checked it out, sign up. It's totally free. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/MacCast. And also be sure to check out the Facebook page. That's over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.